Okay, well, my name is Hadil Asali. I'm a Palestinian American. I've been in the U.S. since I was 2 years old. I'm not a historian or an anthropologist or a scholar by any means. I'm an engineer by trade. But I've been doing activism around Palestine since college. I'm one of the founders for the local Houston Palestine Film Festival, which we're gearing up for our third year now. And our goal is to bring the Palestinian perspective to Houston, you know, from our point of view and from people that recognize Palestine and the many misrepresentations about us in the media. So keep your eyes open for that. That's in April of this year. And that's me.
My name is Ala Al-Azza, and I'm a graduate student at Rice University, doing most of my research and work is on Palestine, in particular the political culture there, and been here for 3 years, and that's it.
I noticed that we have kind of an array of people here, and it would just be good, I think, for us to get a feel for how much, maybe what you're interested to know about, and how much you know, if it's zero or 5%, or, you know, can maybe people just volunteer kind of where you're at? I mean, is the Palestine 101 really too beginner for you, or are there people that really need a Palestine 101?
Well, we came hoping that we could get some background and context for all the news that we've been hearing. I've got some background, but that's why I brought Iris tonight, because there's so much news going around right now, and I don't know that, I think people could use, like, background to...
Why do it? I have a suggestion. Because even if, whether you're 5% or 110% or what have you, even if you, for a discussion, maybe it's good to have some of these things recalled. So if one or either of you could, like, sort of lay out even sort of deep background, like 48, 67, and then subsequently after Oslo and all that sort of jazz.
Go ahead.
First of all, like, I will provide a little bit of background. However, I want to start with a fundamental false statement that I heard over and over in this country, which is people in that part of the world, meaning Palestine, have been fighting for the last 2,000 years as, like, it's a biblical thing. They're fighting forever, and they're going to continue fighting. That's false statement. Palestine is fundamentally a colonial question. Colonial question, what we mean by colonial question, why I want to emphasize the notion of a colonial question, because it started, the problem started with the European colonialism to the rest of the world in the end of the, of, or like with the 18th century. And Palestine has a particularity, which is that the form of settlement that was by a particular group, which is the Zionist particular group, which is the Jewish communities in Europe, that has its their own national imagination and national inspirations, which is primarily a European phenomenon. That's the fundamental moment of conflict. It's primarily colonial conflict. So that's... From when we talk about colonial context or colonial conflict, we talk primarily of national liberation versus colonial power. So when we talk of Palestinians, we have to think of national liberation movement rather than it's a conflict. So it's not a conflict between two parties just for nothing. There is a history of colonialism. People taking other people's land, expel them. And that's primarily the fundamental starting point when we think about Palestine. So that's first.
And the other thing I just want to add to that real quick is that a lot of people also say that it's a religious war, it's a holy war, but that's also another falsehood. It's not a religious war. It's like you said, it's the occupier and the occupied, the colonizer and the colonized.
Now to talk of a little bit about the history, the Zionist movement first conference was in in Bâle in Switzerland, and the idea was to build a Jewish state for the Jewish people. Now the first premise that the Zionist movement came up with was the a land without people for people without land. That was the whole idea, that there's Palestine, there is no people there, and we're going to go and settle in that land. Now that's another problematic starting point when we think of Palestine. Usually, which is also I fall into the same mistake, when I start talking about Palestine, I started as if the history of Palestine started with the Zionist movement, which is also a false statement. This land has been occupied by, like, people are living in that land for history, for centuries. So when we start talking about it, we have to think that people have been lived all their life, like since the beginning of the history, if you want to think about it. But it's not the same. I mean, we're talking contemporary about the 20th century modern national imagination, modern nationalism, that people want simply the right for self-determination. That's the basic line for the Palestinian the Palestinian struggle. So it's a struggle for self-determination. Now, the Zionist movement, with the help of the British colonialism, as just some kind of like general guideline, with the help of the British colonialism, started the foundation or the foundation of the State of Israel since the beginning of the 20th century. Some kind of a implicit or implicit agreement and sometimes explicit agreement between what's known as the Zionist movement and the British colonial force, that this colony that will be created in the Middle East will serve the interests of the British Empire. That was like the simple premise between the relation between the Zionist movement and the European.
The reason that the British were involved is because after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the British had a mandate over Palestine.
Yes.
So the British were really kind of in control of the land of Palestine.
They were the official colonizers. Mm-hmm. However, they facilitate the settlement of European Jews into Palestine, and later on, 1948, the expulsion of 800,000 Palestinians in 1948, and the destruction of 500 towns and villages. So that's 1948.
Now, I just want to add also one more thing. One thing that I tell people, just to make it real simple, like a comparison, and of course, it's not an exact. It's not the exact same scenario, but I often draw a comparison of Zionism and what happened to Palestine in 1948 to what happened right here in this country. You know, you had a European-based colonial movement that came here under this premise of manifest destiny, where they believed that they had the God-given right to this land, and the locals were savages who didn't have, you know, the same beliefs or the same lifestyle as the Europeans, and so it was okay to kick them out and exterminate them. And you'll even find Israeli historians today who will say, who will make that comparison. Benny Morris, for example, says, well, look at America. America is now a great democracy, and in order to do that, they had to expel the natives. So what's the big deal if Israel does the same thing? So that, just to make it real kind of basic, to me, that's the closest comparison that I find, is that what happened to the Palestinians, or what's happening, continuously happening to the Palestinians, because what happened in Gaza recently is, in many of our minds, another attempt at an expulsion, and we'll get into that later. What's happening to the Palestinians is what was done to the Native Americans.
Right. Just elaborate on this, Ali, just because when Allah brought up the doctrine of a land without people for a people with no land, that would further emphasize the correlation that you're making, because although in Australia the doctrine was called terra nullius, a land of no one, in the United States, as you say, it's manifest destiny, but it was constructed on a similar understanding of people not having possession of their land because they had a different understanding of the concept of possession and occupation of land.
However, the particularity of Palestine is that there is another myth which is also propagated by the Zionist movement, and later on Israel, the state of Israel, is that, like, you know, the whole idea is that this vast land or Palestine was a desert, and we made it into this blooming and blooming land. So all these, it's all myths about to legitimize the expulsion and controlling of that land. that's now again to the history. Now the formation of the state of Israel was 1948. What was known as the Palestine, the historic Palestine, under the British mandate, by 1948, Israel controlled 78% of that land. The rest of it, the 23%, what's now known as the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. So this is the land that what's being called right now, the 1967 areas. 1967 areas, the date 1967 is marking the war, which is known also in this country as the Six-Day War, which is another myth that probably I will elaborate on during the questions.
But I think it's important for people to know that the way that the Palestinians were expelled is, you know, there were Jewish terrorist groups, the Irgun and the Haganah, that went to certain villages. One in particular that's very well known is called Deir Yassin. Well, they massacred the entire village. And the word spread to everybody that this was happening. And, of course, people feared for their lives. And they left with the clothing on their back. Many refugees left thinking that they were going to come back in a week or two and everything's going to be okay. And many refugees you'll find in refugee camps around the world still have their keys to their homes, because they thought they were going to come back. And so this is a big point of contention. Israel doesn't want to take responsibility for the refugees because they say, well, we're not responsible. The Arab governments told them to flee. You know, we're not. That's one of the biggest point of contentions now in trying to find to resolve the conflict is Israel doesn't want to absorb the refugees because that's not their problem. We're one of the largest refugee populations in the world, still living in refugee camps, but it's not Israel's problem. And that's one big question, the whole right of return, which is enshrined in UN Resolution 194, but, you know, that's one of the things that Israel will not, is very unwilling to budge on because they're worried about their demographics and being eaten alive by too many Palestinians or something.
So in 1967, back to the history, 1967, Israel occupied the rest of Palestine, which is known, what we describe as the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. That was 1967. Since then, a new era of a new moment of struggle the Palestinians engaged in, which is basically to liberate Palestine. The first moments of a Palestinian national movement was a refugee national movement that want to fight for the right of return, want to liberate its own country. 1967 was a new changes in the Palestinian struggle that now what we call, like, you know, the Palestinians are calling for an independent state in the land of 1967 in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. So this is just a brief kind of guideline about the history, and I would like to her question.
One more thing, sorry, about 1967, that it's, you know, a lot of times you'll hear the Israelis say that, oh, the Arab states were all going to attack them, and it's just this poor country, and everyone's going to attack them. One thing people don't know about 1967 is that that was a preemptive strike. Israel actually started the war in 1967. They wiped out the entire Egyptian Air Force while it was still on the ground.
I mean, on that point, it's important to refer to a famous Israeli historian named Avi Shalem. Avi Shalem has a book called The Iron Wall, and in that book, he specifically pointed that all the wars that Israel engaged in were preemptive and aggressive wars of aggression, rather than, except within one case, 1973 Suez Canal War, what's known as Yom Kippur War. So just so that's like a famous Israeli historian who went to the archive and acknowledged, like, this is all through the archive of the Israeli archive. So it's. I mean, I would like to point out something here about Gaza, the recent event in Gaza, versus the previous wars that Israel engaged in. In all the wars that that happened in the Middle East, Israel claimed before the last, in the last, before the last, before the current, like before 2000 probably, that it, all these wars, Israel is a victim of other people's aggression. And the idea that we are weak, we are small, tiny country, we are defending against all this, the, these Arab countries against us. This time, probably the only war about Gaza that they explicitly said that we are strong and we're going to teach them a lesson. So that's probably the only difference, is that there were like all the claims that of victimhood, and now at least they acknowledge that they are the strongest army in the region and they are fighting against people with no unarmed people, civilians.
Although initially the propaganda was that they were defending themselves and that Hamas broke the ceasefire, until it finally came clear that it was actually Israel that broke the ceasefire when they invaded, when they had an incursion November 4th.
But I mean, honestly, sorry to cut you off on that, but there is another problem in the logic of dealing with the Palestinian struggle, is that as we want to start from now and here, this is like, you know, that's the starting point, is the ceasefire. The ceasefire is not the starting point. The starting point is the occupation, is the struggle for self-determination.
Basic rights, yeah. I mean, you're talking about a ceasefire,
so,
but at the same
that's
time,
another
people
point,
don't have food, people don't have access. I mean, there's a lot of focus on who broke the ceasefire, but there's not, you know, it kind of took away from, let's just look at the big picture here, let's look at who has the biggest guns. Israel has the fourth largest army in the world, the fourth most powerful army in the world. Let's look at who controls all the borders. Let's look at who controls what goes in and out, who goes in and out. I mean, I tried to visit my family in the Gaza Strip twice, in 2005 and in 2006. I can't even get in. Foreign journalists can't get in. So who's really in control? What you have here is someone that has all the power and someone that has no power. You've got the prisoner and the imprisoned. So it's not a matter of a ceasefire. It's a matter of, you know, one side has a history of being belligerent and has all everything is in their hands, and also has a very powerful propaganda machine. I mean, I'm amazed, like when I talk to some of my coworkers and just the stuff that's really, really inundated in their heads, you know, and just normal average people who don't know much of anything. But Israel has historically been and still continues to be very effective at promoting the propaganda, starting with it's a land without a people for people without a land, and they made the desert bloom, to now that they're defending themselves against Hamas.
So I think it's better to have questions rather than...
Yeah, I mean, there's several different aspects we can talk about, refugees, the wall,
because
resources,
there's multiple issues.
It'd be interesting to hear what you guys have questions about, you know, if there's anything that you heard that you're not sure about that we can try to set straight, or please.
Yeah. What's the real genuine relationship between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority right now? I mean, how is that dynamic working?
The history, we have to start with the moment that Hamas participated in the election of 2006. 2007, I'm sorry. 2007. There was an election.
Start earlier. Start with what is Hamas and what is...
What's the Hamas? Oh, okay. Now, again, the Palestinian National Movement. When we talk of the Palestinian National Movement, we talk of multiple organizations, multiple political and ideological backgrounds. Since the beginning of the Palestinian National Movement, the modernist Palestinian National Movement in the 60s, it was predominantly secular national movement. There was a strong leftist, primarily Marxist-Leninist elements in the PLO. 1988 or 1987, December 1987, a new movement emerged in Gaza Strip and the West Bank called Hamas. It belonged to the Islamic with an Islamic ideology that want a liberation of Palestine with a lot of with a strong religious influence. That was 1987.
So possibly with Muslim
Brotherhood. Yeah.
But the whole time, it's really been the primary movers and shakers in the leadership have been Fatah, Arafat's party, right? And then there were other parties like the PFLP, the DFLP. There's another smaller Islamic group called the Islamic Jihad. But the main party leading up to the last election was Fatah. And at that point, people had gotten so fed up with the corruption in the Palestinian Authority. It was to the point where they found out that Palestinian Authority members were selling concrete to Israel for building the wall. You know, that they were facilitating that. It was really scandalous stuff. And so during that election, everybody from Muslims to Christians to seculars to traditionally Fatah supporters, we had a higher voter turnout than any election in American history. Maybe not this last election, I'm not sure. But a much higher voter turnout to kick them out. And it was really to teach them a lesson more than anything. You know, even when you have even Christians voting for Hamas, you know, the point was people were sick of the corruption and they wanted to teach them a lesson.
I'm sorry, what's the relationship?
Stand for Palestinian Liberation Organization, and it's a constellation of different parties. Fatah is basically the Palestinian National Liberation Movement. There is the PFLP, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. There is the DFLP, the Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine. And there is the Communist Party, and all these are under the umbrella of PLO, the main organization that all of them under. So that's the clarification.
Would you shed a bit of light on the State of Israel's funding of Hamas in order to create an Islamist counterbalance to the secular?
This is historically a little bit doubted facts. The State of Israel facilitated the presence of the Islamist groups in the West Bank and Gaza Strip in the 80s while they were attacking and severely attacking the national movement. And the idea was to create some kind of a counterbalance to PLO influence in the West Bank and Gaza Strip by supporting, or at least facilitating, or closing one eye on the religious movement's activities. So when simply as if there would be a cultural center that related somehow to the national movement, it would be completely closed. The only social places are the mosques. So those elements basically facilitated the presence of Hamas. However, it's unfair historically to say that it was created by Hamas was created by the State of Israel, as well as that there was their own within Palestinian society there is its own social dynamics, that transformation, that the religious movement basically gained power and trust of the population, and that it's not our right. I mean, that's the thing, is it's not our right to define what people's ideological background is. If you want to discuss the fundamental question of people want self-determination, they can decide whatever their form of government. It's not our right to impose our own ideas on them. And that's what happened after the recent election. In the recent election, the Palestinian population voted for Hamas as a majority in the Palestinian parliament. Now, because the Western liberal democracy, the idea of Western liberal democracy is, especially in this country and also in Europe, has so much hypocrisy, a fundamental Hippocratic notion, because uh, or Fundamentally, it's hypocritic, because if you don't vote the way I want you to vote, we're going to change the rule. Like, you know, it's like we're going to put you under embargo, under sanction. That's what happened with the Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, did
they vote for the wrong side. The question is the wrong side between, like, you know.
They cut off the funding that's collected from Palestinian taxes and goes to pay teachers and government employees that were employed through the Palestinian Authority. So when I was there in 2006, people hadn't been paid for months. They just didn't have, they weren't being paid, you know, because it was basically their punishment for electing the wrong government. Now, how do Hamas and Fatah, how are their relations now? It's really hard to say, because Hamas is really primarily in control of the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinian Authority is really more the stronghold in the West Bank. But I know, for example, that Hamas has tried to dismantle some of the kind of poor deals that the Palestinian Authority did. For example, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but there was a huge natural gas field discovered off the coast of the Gaza Strip, which may, you know, shed some light on what happened lately, maybe. But there was a huge natural gas field discovered off the coast of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Authority was trying to work out a deal with, I think it was with British Petroleum and Israel and whatnot, to make sure that they can develop it, and the Palestinian Authority was only going to get 10% of the proceeds of the profits, right? So Hamas came and put an end to that and said, that's not fair. And, soon afterwards.
But like, you know, fundamentally the idea is that why people voted for Hamas. There's multiple reasons for why people voted for Hamas. One of them was the internal corruption of the Palestinian Authority, which, like, you know, I don't think this was actually that major corruption, but the Palestinian population were actually well-educated and aware of the need for a good government, and that's why they voted against the existing power structure. However, there is another important factor, which is since 1992, 1993, the first Palestinian PLO-Israel negotiation process started, and till 2000. That was like 8 years of negotiation that the Palestinians saw how the colonial policies actually, the settlements, confiscation of land, more arrest of the people, pushing the people to more of like Pentustan style. It became transformed. The Israeli form of colonial administration transformed from not only like military occupation to an apartheid system. And it was obvious for everybody that the peace process, what's called the peace process, is leading nowhere. And that's why people turned against it and actually voted for a more radical group. And the only present radical group that wasn't corrupt was Hamas. That's simple. People were like fed up with the peace process and the corruption, which is the corruption itself, which is another point. I think it's a structural component. It's like fundamentally part of the peace process was the creation, was this facilitation of corruption. So we can talk about that.
How politically feasible is it for Israel to get rid of the settlements in the West Bank? Because, properly speaking, they are occupying it. That is an act of war in many respects.
Well, I want to answer that. I don't think Israel has any intention of getting rid of those settlements. The year that Israel pulled out the settlements from Gaza, they took out 8,000 settlers from there, and they put 12,000 in the West Bank. You know, and I don't know if you've seen maps of the West Bank now, but I mean, it's some of the most fertile land. It's the huge water sources. There's no clear. I mean, even during the. And I wanted to talk about what I was going to say about the negotiations. One of my friends makes a joke that these negotiations are kind of like if you and I have a pizza, right? Like we have a pizza, we slice up the pizza, and we start negotiating who gets what slice. So we're negotiating, and while we're negotiating, I start eating the pizza. So, like, these negotiations are happening under the so-called, you know, peaceful, these were peaceful times when there was no fighting, no intifada, and Palestinians are watching more and more and more. I remember when I was there in 99, every single hilltop had a big billboard on it and they had like the name of the future settlement, because at the time this policy was grab all the hilltops. And I tell you what, those hilltops are covered now. They all have settlements on them now.
I mean, the question of political feasibility is, I don't think that it's the question should be posed to a Palestinian here. I mean, I think it's the question that should be, Israel should answer that question, because let's face it, I mean, like, you know, when there is a political will, everything become more of like technical, more of a logistic issue. So as Hadil pointed out, it's like it doesn't seem that Israel has a political will to go for a peaceful settlement in Palestine, in like, you know, with the Palestinians. It's, I mean, at least the facts on the ground does not show.
They're still expanding.
Well, I was going to ask if you can talk about the formation of the Palestinian Authority before, and then come back to for present day stuff.
Okay.
To go through that.
1993, PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, had a negotiation with Israel, and the idea was they're going to give the Palestinians an interim government, like a form of autonomy that will lead by 99, like after 5 to 6 years, to an independent Palestinian state in the occupied land in 1967. That was also agreement. At least that's how is the ideal, how it was presented to the population. Now, within that time, the Palestinian Authority formed. It's some kind of semi-government, semi-autonomy. It has like has a control of the population, but has no control of resources and land. There is more technical details on that. However, the idea is that it has no sovereignty. There is no. It's not a recognized political entity that can actually consider a sovereign political entity. And from there,
could you clarify that? You mean it was supposed to become sovereign in 1999?
Yeah, it was supposed to become a Palestinian state.
But in the interim period,
never happened. Yeah. Right. So that's. So that was like from 1999 till 2000. What is called the Palestinian Authority. Now, within the Palestinian Authority has its own charter and its own legal framework that included, like, you know, the idea of election, periodic election. 1996, January 1996, there was the first election that the National Secular Movement basically had a majority, had like, you know, the absolute majority, and then the second election took place 2 years ago, and that Hamas won the election. So, is that clear? More clarification? So, 1993. The formation of the Palestinian
government. As being a Palestinian as well, and seeing different governments that govern the Palestinians, what is your opinion on Hamas and how they represent us? Because the citizens and the civilians are not able to voice their opinions. It's usually the radical government. So how do you feel it represents the actual civilians?
Well, what I'll say is that what I know about Palestinian society is that historically it's always been a secular society. It's never been one that had a religious leadership in it. I know, for example, actually, Hadad was telling me this story, how they there was this book of folk tales that's taught in the schools. Which one is it? Was it you that was telling the story? That they had this book of folk tales, right? These are like mythological folk tales that are taught in the schools. And Hamas wanted them banned from the schools because they saw them as blasphemy, you know, if they want Islamic stories taught or whatnot. Well, the Palestinians are not known for keeping their mouth shut, so they basically told them back off, and of course they backed off. So I think that there's certain limits to what Hamas can do in terms of imposing themselves on the society. Unfortunately, you're right, you know, the more, I guess the trend that I see is that the more and more America does what's doing in the Middle East and what Israel is doing, it's really fueling a lot more of this radical Islam. So, and it's just really unfortunate because you know, people see Afghanistan as the threat, or they see Iraq as the threat, but yet they don't see Bush being chummy-chummy with the Saudi king, and Saudi Arabia as the birthplace of the Wahhabi movement, which is this very fundamentalist Islamic movement. So I think that part of the problem is that the West is not really, really interested in dismantling the radical form of Islam because it gives them mm-hmm. their enemy, you know.
And so they're interested in, you know, basically name-calling them and going against them.
Yeah, it gives them a reason to be in Iraq, right? Supposedly.
Yeah,
it gives them a reason to be where they are, so.
On the same point, I mean, unfortunately, in our modern societies, we don't have any other means of representing the population except the election. And the election results in Palestine brought Hamas in power. And they were never given a chance to actually govern or even represent the population or represent what their platform. It's not all, like they were put under embargo. There was, like, you know, a siege and
there was a true sabotage by Israel and the U.S. Their election was their authority was sabotaged. But it's also important, you know, to know that all these other parties, like the PFLP, for example, any other alternative to Fatah or Hamas was completely, like, had their legs cut out from under them. Their leaders were either imprisoned or exiled or assassinated. You know, so there's, and the, you know, and the PFLP was a party that, you know, many people identified with, but because it was something that was made sense, you know, and was secular and whatnot, that was, they deemed that more, but to the point where they'll even assassinate their poets and their writers and you know. So any other alternative was deemed, you know, was made illegitimate. So, and Fatah was, or at least the Palestinian Authority, the ones that were the most willing to compromise and take money under the table and compromise, they were the only ones that they're willing to work with. So the people said, we don't want you anymore. And Hamas was the only other alternative.
I kind of see, like, the history as being, like, kind of endemic of, like, the neo-imperialism that happened after World War II, and how, like, colonialism reinserted itself into different countries, or how, like, you have the Third World Movement trying to take, like, control of having an economy and stuff, and how the Palestinian struggle is pretty much, like, similar, it's not the same, but it's similar to, like, that of, like, Mozambique and, like, Angola, all those other countries that were fighting for, like, the right to self-determination. And I kind of feel that, like, at least within the media, and at least in America, there's not enough, like, talk about, like, how this connects to, like, Western civilization, how it connects to, like, propagating those ideals of this country and, like, this creationist story of America, how, like, Israel's a further extension of that creationist story of Russian, Western civilization. But, like, how in that, you know, I just kind of feel in our education and how history is written and how we don't really have any autonomy over our own history here in this country. And how, like, we don't really seek those kind of answers to colonialism, or bring it back to colonialism, or really make the connection that the same stuff was happening here in the United States with, like, the Black Panthers and the United States organizations, and all these different places where, like, these, like, if you want to call them nationalist movements in the United States, were trying to get their autonomy during the 60s and 70s, but they were definitely killed and definitely wiped off, and how those connections are somehow lost. And how I think, like, the Palestinian struggle is definitely a struggle against Western civilization and against the foundations of, like, how we sit here and how we commerce and how we do all these things. So I mean, I don't know, but, I mean, do the Palestinians, because, like, I saw, like, that Slingshot movie, the hip-hop one, and how they're making the comparisons, but how, like, I mean, the Irish, the IRA, they're making the comparisons, but, like, how we have a trouble making those kind of linkages between us and, like, larger movements.
Can I try and connect up a couple of those threads, though?
I'm sorry?
Can I try and connect up a couple of those threads for a second, just because it's a little broader? It just in regard to what you said about post, the post-World War II colonization, the differentiation that needs to be made, I think, has to do with, and in fact it speaks to things going beyond a colonial situation that is within that example. It breaks down like this. Before 1989, essentially, under the Cold War, you had two world powers that were able to manipulate public governments. Now you have internal actors operating within states who can be constructed by the U.S. through the media so that any given government can be a target based on their moderateness, which is defined essentially through their capacity. And I'm quoting Osama Maktisi essentially from what he was talking about the other night at a different event, wherein essentially being a moderate is conjugated under the terms of whether or not you agree with the U.S. You could be Gaddafi, you can be a moderate if you change as he did recently. You could be Musharraf, but you can slip, as has happened, back and forth between being a moderate or not.
The king of Saudi Arabia. Yeah. I mean, that's a prime
example. So what I would say is, in fact, you pointing to that historical circumstance, in fact, things are much more intensely colonial now under neo-colonial mechanisms. We just don't have the same kind of grammar to talk about it because of media disinformation, right? But